And we are live.
We're all filtering in now. We'll wait a couple of minutes for everyone to get up to the numbers we normally do, and then we can start yabbering on. Oh gosh, that's quick. Look at that. Wow, thanks everyone for joining us today. So we really appreciate you coming today to talk to us about these really important issues that we're going to be speaking to you about over the next hour or so. First of all, I just want to do a quick intro for anybody that doesn't know us, but I suspect that a lot of you are RP and lovely attendees anyway. But for those who don't know us, we're MPM Legal. We specialise in employment law. And we also offer another arm of MPM Included, which is run by our lovely Sarah over there. I'm Verity Saxon, and I have been working at MPM for just over a year now. I'm a lawyer for much longer than that. It's about a decade now, but once I get to that stage, I just stop counting, if I'm honest with you. I'm delighted to be joined by Sarah and Adrienne, my lovely colleagues. Mm-hmm. And also, delighted to be joined by two very special guests who are going to come and talk to us about some of these specialist subjects that they deal with. First of all, Meredith Brown. She is our diversity and inclusion specialist and trained coach. She's also the co-founder of Caring Collaborative Coaching, and that organisation supports businesses and employees to create a menopause inclusive workplace. And we're also delighted to be joined by Emma Menzies, who is a fertility at work coach, and she specialises in coaching professional women through their fertility challenges. So thank you, ladies, for joining us today. Look, we've got really interesting, thought-provoking session for you. We've got three key topics that we want to cover today, which are menopause, periods, and fertility and pregnancy loss. So for a trigger warning for anybody, we will be talking about pregnancy loss. I think it's important for us to mention that. If I'm honest with you, this has been a long time coming, this session, because it kind of came about through personal experiences last year, and Sarah and Adrienne and I talking about, why are we not talking about these things? You know, they're happening to us personally, but why are we not talking about them? And I think we wanted to wait until the right time to really do that and have, you know, the right sort of guest speakers. Because look, we're women and we know about these things, but these aren't our specialist areas. And so we wanted to make sure that we were dealing with it in the right way. So we are now at a stage where we can do that because we've got Emma and Meredith to help us here today. So for the next 45 minutes, we're going to be talking to you about these three areas. We're absolutely more than welcome to take any questions as we normally do, and they'll be spoken anonymously. So do use the question function or the chat function, whichever you feel more comfortable with, and the session will be recorded. So you may all be sitting there when you got the invite thinking, why are three employment lawyers talking about periods, menopause and pregnancy loss? And at first it does seem a bit strange to some people, but the truth of the matter is, this is life, isn't it? You know, we're women. This happens to us. This is, we mentioned it when we all got together on Monday. This is the life cycle of women, you know, periods, fertility, if you choose to have children, and menopause. So, you know, undoubtedly it impacts us personally, and how that is not going to impact the workplace, you know, is beggar's belief. So it does, and I think it's important for us to normalize these conversations about it and understand how it impacts women and men, because men, you know, support women through these issues in the workplace, so that managers and businesses are offering their staff the right support. I think that's really the fundamental thing here. And, you know, Adrienne and Sarah and I talk regularly about different topics, and, you know, we're very fortunate to have a platform where we can speak. So I think it's important for us to use that to raise awareness on topics like this. You know, we're only going to be able to touch the surface, if I'm honest with you, in the next 45 minutes on these issues. So what we really want to do is give you an idea of where to start. What can you do as a business? you know, there are legal implications, obviously, for what we're going to be talking about, but we're not really going to be delving into that. But I do want to mention it briefly that obviously, if anybody is treated unfairly in respect of any of these issues, then you may have a potential for a discrimination claim being brought against you as a business for either sex or perhaps pregnancy, if it's pregnancy loss related, or maybe even a disability or unfair dismissal. So just have that in mind. But today, what we want to do is address the practicalities of addressing these in the workplace. Like I said, we're not going to be able to do this justice. So I think the hope is that we can, in the future, in the next couple of months, have a more in-depth roundtable discussion about these issues. If that's something that you're interested in, then do drop us a line. And one last thing before we start, I just want to ping over to Sarah to briefly mention, I think it would be foolish for us to not talk about the D&I aspect here. So Sarah, I'm just going to hand over to you, if that's okay.
Of course, thank you. So yeah, I mean, look, women form half the population of this country. They don't quite form half the workforce, but they're certainly very present in the workforce. There are still lots of workplaces globally, not just in this country, that were built around a model that was based on only having men in the office or in the factory or wherever you happen to be working. And there's a really interesting book that I've read by a lady called Michelle P. King, who is a specialist in this area. The book's called The Fix, if anyone wants to read it. It's fascinating. But she talks about a workplace built around a Don Draper prototype. So for those of you who like Mad Men, I think you'll know what I mean. That sort of 1960s advertising, men in the office, very few women. If they are, they're kind of, to use one of my favourite Essex phrases, dolly birds, who are sort of dripping around making tea for people. And I think part of the reason that these issues are hard to talk about, and I'll be honest, I put a post on LinkedIn last night about periods and I felt really awkward about it, and I've had periods myself for 30 years but I still felt really awkward about it. But part of the reason is because there is still this piece that workplaces were built by men and for men, and if you are different to the Don Draper prototype that Michelle King talks about, then you're trying to fit in to something that isn't you. And I think that's really, really important to just hold that in our heads as we go through this conversation from an inclusion perspective. You know, workplaces need to change, in my view, so that they include everyone and so that there's space for everyone. But I'm not convinced that the way to do that is to make everyone fit into the current structure. And I think we need to look much more widely at the structures. And that's actually part of what we're doing here is, as Verity said, we've got a platform and we're having this conversation in order to make the space for people to feel more included and to start making it acceptable for people to talk about these issues. And Meredith, I mean, your whole role away from your coaching role is to head up D&I. So I'm sure you've got some thoughts on that. But would you tend to agree with that view?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's all about creating a workplace where people can turn up and just be all the parts of themselves that they are and not have to hide or park a bit at the front door, you know, because that just makes for a much better, productive, happier workplace.
100%. Yep. So yeah, very much part of the inclusion conversation, and it's just great to be able to kind of look at this with that lens as well today.
Well, so shall we, let's kick off. Let's start with menopause.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've already touched on the legal aspects, but I mean, obviously menopause is something that I think everybody going through it is going to experience it differently. Symptoms are hugely wide ranging, and you know, at their worst they can be seriously debilitating. You know, and they can be physical symptoms, but they can also be mental symptoms. And a bit like Sarah, you're saying you're feeling, you know, you felt a bit a bit awkward about raising the issue of having periods, that's exactly what many women will feel like when they're going through this. And they may not actually understand themselves, but Meredith, but you know, why are we talking about this at this, you know, at this juncture? Why is it so important? You can lend some thoughts.
Yeah, why is it so important to businesses and employers? Well, we know that 8 out of 10 women who are going through menopause are in the workplace. So that's a huge number. And as you said, you know, the majority of these women are experiencing a whole plethora of symptoms, which we know impact both outside and inside the workplace. And 80%, over 80% of women report feeling that these symptoms negatively impact, you know, in the workplace. So, you know, that makes it something that's really important for workplaces. And that's often reflected in the workplace by increased absence. So staff taking off, you know, periods of time, reduced productivity, women even leaving, you know, the workplace, leaving their job. We know that 25% of women consider, 25% of menopause women consider leaving the workplace, and almost 1 million women have left the workplace, you know, because of struggling with menopause and menopause symptoms.
And do you think, sorry, just in terms of people leaving their jobs, in your experience, is that because they felt that they've not been able to talk about it, or because they haven't been heard, or is it a mixture of those types of issues?
It's a mixture. So definitely feeling that they just can't speak up. You know, it's not a culture where they feel they can comfortably speak up about it, and that they'll be listened to, they'll be taken seriously, and that there is there is support available to them that can help them with managing, you know, their symptoms. And I think, you know, for some women, they worry that if they speak up, this is going to affect their career, it's going to affect, you know, opportunities, it's going to affect the way that people, you know, look at them and think of them as somebody within the workplace.
Which kind of comes back, doesn't it, to that Don Draper prototype that I mentioned, because actually why should it affect? If you think about it logically, if it's normal for women to be in the workplace and this is a normal part of being a woman, why should it affect them? And yet, because we're still in that, you know, subconsciously or otherwise, we're still in that sort of, you know, fit this mold or nothing else arena. That's the impact.
Yeah, there's a lot of taboo around, you know, talking about the subject. It's not something that's been, you know, talked about. It's always been thought of something that should just happen and you should just sort of get on with it. And we really need to change that. We need to bring it out into the open. We need to get people, you know, talking positively and respectfully about menopause.
So in your sort of experience of dealing with this, how do we start that conversation? How as an employer what have you seen in terms of how that conversation has begun?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question, is it? Where do you start? And I think it's about initially laying some really solid foundations. And there's a few things organisations can look at to do that. And I think the first one is around educating and awareness, you know, across the organisation. This is something that affects everybody, and that will help stimulate that conversation and get that normalizing of the conversation around menopause. So that's really important.
I've seen some organizations start to have things like a policy in place. Now, I'm not a massive fan about having policies on anything, but surely having a policy in place, it raises that awareness straight away, doesn't it?
You absolutely know, I mean, having a policy or even guidance, guidance, it just it visibly demonstrates the organization's commitment to taking menopause seriously. And it can include, you know, a lot of really valuable information, both for women, for line managers who are, you know, looking to better manage women, you know, and understand menopause. So a policy or guidance can be a really useful signposting place. And I think the other thing that's probably important is to think about how can you create opportunities for women to come together So women who are experiencing menopause, you know, coming together to share their experiences and their ideas. And this can really help with the isolation, the feeling of isolation that a lot of women, you know, feel, you know, during menopause. And you know, it can be a very supportive group. So that's something that's really worth thinking about too.
Yeah. I think also on that, it occurs to me as someone who hasn't yet gone through the menopause. I sometimes wonder if I'm perimenopausal or not. But I would love to have people to talk to who can, because I don't know. And you're right with that taboo, Meredith. I think this is changing, and I think it's so positive that it's changing. But I want to ask people. I want to know people who've had a really easy experience, people who've had a terrible experience. I want to know what it's like, because even as women, if you take away the workplace aspect for a moment, we don't talk about this stuff in my experience. And that retains the taboo and makes it something that's quite daunting as a 42-year-old woman sort of with this ahead of me.
Yeah. I also think it's somebody's added a really important comment in the chat function, which is, it's not, you know, when we're talking about menopause, we mustn't forget the, you know, perimenopause and all the rest of it. Because I think one of the things as well, when we're getting women talking to each other, is helping them to recognize what they're going through. Because, I mean, I didn't know whether I was perimenopausal or whether I was just seriously grumpy, angry, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it was like, what the hell is happening to me? Because so to that extent, I think it's really important to be able to say, I'm feeling like this. Is that normal? What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, and to encourage that sharing of experiences, because it not only brings it out into the workplace, but you end up supporting each other.
Yeah, you're right. And that's a really good point that individuals made about perimenopause, because we often say menopause as the term, but we're including perimenopause, which of course, you know, can start generally in your 40s. I mean, 1% of women, it can start before that, naturally before you're 40, but and that's when you start experiencing the symptoms, actually. And for many women, and for myself, you know, you didn't even realize, you know, you'd put it down to something else. Some women even put it down to, you know, things like early onset dementia, when they suddenly can't remember things and can't recall facts. And so that's another reason why it's really important to raise awareness.
Yeah,
and raise awareness, I think, in women who are approaching menopause, you know, younger women, you know, getting it into high school education, so that, you know, not just focusing perhaps on perimenopause and menopausal women, but before that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's only when I look back, when you know, I think at one point I attributed the anxiety, because I think that's quite a big thing that a lot of women go through. I mean, I've been really fortunate not to have much in the way of physical symptoms, but certainly I remember at one stage having sort of real anxiety, where I've never suffered from anxiety before, and I put it down to, you know, work-related stress, for example. So, you know, there's the classic example of the individual themselves not really understanding what they're going through, and if they can't understand it, then the manager's not going to understand it. And
that's right.
You know, and that's how that comes into the workplace. It's only looking back going, duh, of course. You know, it's just, it's like,
and some of the wider issues with that, of course, are that women will often go to their GP and they'll say, oh, you know, I'm experiencing this anxiety. I'm not sure where it's coming from. Even little things, I'm really stressed about them. And, you know, GPs don't have the knowledge around menopause either. And that's, you know, something that's being addressed by this new menopause task force. You know, they say, oh, well, you're suffering depression, anxiety, here are some tablets, off you go. And actually what you might well be is you may have entered perimenopause.
And I can't remember whether it was you I was talking to, Sarah, or another one of my friends, and that's exactly what happened to them. They went off to the doctor, they were told they needed antidepressants. They didn't. They, you know, they needed to recognise what was going through their body. And the minute they went on to HRT, it was like a cloud had lifted. And so it wasn't a depression-based thing. It was the physical changes that they were going through. So I think that's a really, really valid point.
Yeah.
And I think this is why we've got to like bang this drum and have this conversation going on. I I follow Caroline Hirons, who's a skincare guru, for completely unrelated reasons on Instagram. I don't follow many people on Instagram because I don't really understand it, but that's someone I follow on Instagram. And she's been really vocal about exactly that point, which also happened to her. She went through the perimenopause in her early 40s. She was bloated. She was depressed. She was full of brain fog. And, you know, for years she struggled on. And then one day she saw the right GP or the right specialist and she got HRT. And I know HRT isn't for everyone. I'm not advocating one way or another. But for her, it was like a Damascalian conversion. You know, she was well and back on her game. And, you know, I think this is why these kind of conversations are so important, because we've got to get the message out there. And help people to understand what's going on.
Yeah. There are some interesting comments in the chat. I noticed here someone's mentioned sort of the neurological or cognitive impacts of menopause. And there is some research that's starting to come out in this area, and it's fascinating. And it kind of links into the second, there was another comment, I think, below it by another person who was talking about the variety of symptoms. And it's just incredible how estrogen, you know, that there are estrogen receptors all over our body responsible for so many different functions, you know, and there's the cognitive piece. And that is why, you know, every woman's experience of menopause is so unique. And you can't expect that what will work for one woman will work for, you know, for another woman. Or even that a woman might be comfortable speaking up about it. Actually, that's something else you have to be quite careful of. You know, you may be in an organization and you maybe want to encourage conversation and encouraging women to speak up, but actually a woman has to be comfortable speaking up.
Yeah. And on that point, go ahead, Emma.
That's so important with all of these issues, isn't it? Is the temptation to make comparisons and judgments and think, well, my periods aren't like that, or my miscarriage wasn't like that, or my friend's wasn't, my mum's wasn't, you know, same with menopause. And, you know, the real key to supporting it is to really explore each individual experience and accept it for what it is and try and release those judgments so that you can support it properly.
And I'm just sort of coming back to that. I read a lovely article online, and it was in the financial services sector, actually, where it wasn't like a case study, but it was a comment that, you know, a woman was going through it, felt, you know, was having hot flushes, and her manager, because he had the experience of supporting his wife at home, and I know we can't control what goes on at home, but had that experience, recognised it, but instead of going, you know, are you menopausal? Because clearly that's not the educated way to jump in. He said, yes, it is really warm in here. Let's open a window. Took his sweater off so he could show that bit of compassion and understanding. Mm-hmm. And therefore that sort of built that relationship with that employee. So a few days later, he felt like he was able to raise the conversation and encourage her to talk to him. So I think in terms of that comes back round to how do we have the conversation, because, you know, managers have a lot on their plates, right? From a legal perspective, we see it all the time. How can we expect them to deal with this? And that comes back to the education piece. And I'll come back to, you know, if you've got a policy or you've got your guidance in place, then as a business, you've then got something to train people against, because you've raised it.
Yeah, it comes back to the education piece, and it comes back to upskilling managers to be able to have these sensitive and feel comfortable having these sensitive conversations. And yeah. I sort of see it that, you know, managers see their team on a regular basis, and part of managing their team is to be interested and care about their well-being and what's concerning them in the moment. And, you know, menopause or whatever, you know, other wider things are included in that. And it's just how they can do that in a really sensitive and respectful way.
Yeah, I think that's right, because let's face it, a decent performing employee, one who's, you know, regularly been at work, doesn't suddenly stop overnight if there isn't something there, isn't it? So it's not always saying, oh, you must be menopausal. It might be the, you know, what's going on? You don't seem yourself, you know, and it's that type of conversation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's been them being able to, with that knowledge that they've got and those skills they've got, be able to, you know, listen really, isn't it? And listen without the intent to respond, but just to acknowledge and appreciate and recognize and then support that person in front of them with their, you know, the unique needs that they have.
I'm just going to pick up on this. There's a couple of comments on the chat, which I think is really, really important. And it comes back to the point of we can't control what's going on at home. But really valid point being made is, you know, we need to educate, you know, boys and girls at home as to what's going on. You know, but there is sort of PSHE lessons at school where, you know, boys are taught about periods. I mean, I've got two teenage boys and my son came to talk to me and about his girlfriend, but, you know, being very angry and stroppy with him at one point. And he asked about it. He said, what's going on? How do I deal with it, etc. And, you know, and I think it's really important that we have that conversation with them. And I'm talking to my kids about menopausal issues, even though my 15-year-old goes, "Oh, don't really want to hear it." But you know, the more normalised we make it, the more we share our experiences, then we're going to produce adults that go into the world much better able to deal with this, so they won't become the Don Drapers. God forbid! Yeah. I'd be horrified if my boys turned into Don Drapers.
I completely agree with that. Yeah, I've got two teenage boys as well, and at the moment I'm waking up every hour, it feels, during the night, you know, with night sweats, and I'm not particularly a friendly person in the morning. And so, you know, I'm explaining that to them. I'm saying, look, Mum's pretty tired this morning, so, you know, I need you to do this for me, and I'm sorry if I'm a bit grumpy. And I think, you know, it's then they get curious, they ask the questions, and, you know, that's what it's all about, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I said to mine, you know, my 18-year-old has come out the other side of being the grunting teenager, where I said to him, a lot of this is not down to you, it's down to your hormonal changes. Mm. And that's exactly what I go through as well. You know, you've gone through it and you've been grumpy. I'm now going through a similar thing, and, you know, hormonal changes happen.
Yeah,
I think we probably need to think about moving on. So Meredith, one final thought then, if we were going to, you know, if this is all a little bit overwhelming as a business in terms of how we get it started, what would be the one thing that you would suggest to a business or an HR team that they can do to start this conversation?
Yeah, it's really about getting this out in the open. And how can you do that? You know, awareness training involving the whole office is a really good place to start. I think the other thing to be thinking about is talking to women in the organization, and maybe you can do this through your networks, and understanding what is their need, you know, and talking to line managers and understanding, you know, what is your need, what do you need, so that we can create, you know, this really inclusive workplace for women who are going through menopause.
Great.
Brilliant. Sarah, do you want to chip in on periods? Should we start that conversation?
Let's talk about periods. Well, I have had 30 years of periods. I can remember when I was 12, it was quite exciting, you know, seeing who'd got their period and who hadn't amongst the girls. I'm not sure having had 30 times 12, apart from when I was pregnant, periods ever since, that I see it as quite as exciting as I did when I was 12. In fact, quite often, I think it could do one, to be honest, but there we go. But on a serious note, I'm going to, as I so often do, give what may be too much information for some people, but I'm going to talk about myself first and then talk a bit more widely about periods in the workplace. So when I was a teenager, I was quite unfortunate in that I suffered with something called, I didn't know it was called this, by the way, but I do now, called dysmenorrhea, which is basically extremely painful periods. So I used to have to take prescribed painkillers for it. And it was bloody awful, pardon the pun. And I think that kind of dissipated once I started using the pill as birth control. That kind of sorted out my periods as well, so that was quite helpful. In terms of periods in the workplace, between babies, I didn't want to be on hormonal birth control, so I went the traditional route and used a coil. And I can remember in meetings, I was working at Barclays at the time, which is where Emma and I worked together many, many years ago. And I can remember it being in meetings and thinking, if I don't leave this meeting, I'm going to bleed through. Actually, people are going to see that I've got my period, because it was so heavy, and I would bleed through a tampon very, very quickly. And that was dreadful. I mean, it was so utterly mortifying just sitting there thinking, I'm going to have to leave. Can I even get up? I don't really want to leave this meeting right now, but I need to, you know. So that was not the most fun. Both at work and at home, up until relatively recently, if I had my period, I would scuttle off to the loo with a great big handbag, hoping that people would just think that I was going to touch up my makeup, because those who know me well know I love makeup. And then I just thought, oh my goodness, I can't, this is ridiculous. Why should it be so embarrassing to be seen with a tampon in my hand? Like, I'm a woman, I have periods. I think the more recent update for me, and shout out to the person who mentioned the perimenopause, is probably in the last couple of years, you know, and I think there are possibly all sorts of reasons for this, including perhaps the perimenopause, because I think the last couple of years have been very strange for everyone. But I have definitely noticed a marked increase in the differences in my hormonal cycle. And I would say that I have one day a month, almost without fail, where it is very, very hard to operate. I am very low. I find it very hard to get out of bed in the morning. I normally leap out of bed to go and do some kind of exercise or other, or yoga, or just potter around my house in the quiet without anyone else there. But that day, I can be quite paranoid. I can be very sensitive about what people say to me. I generally end up weeping at some point or another. And it's just one day, but it is, you know, I had a conversation with my husband a while ago, because he's super supportive and actually probably recognizes it more quickly than I do, and then sort of hesitates about whether he dares tell me or not, but that's what particular day we've reached. But I said to him, look, you know, this is what my life has been like for 30 years. I'm not steady every day. My hormones do not allow me to be that. There is a cycle that I go through, and sometimes that has a really positive impact, and sometimes it's actually quite negative and it's quite hard to function. But that is part of being a woman, and therefore if you work, it's part of being a working woman. I'm very fortunate because I don't suffer with endometriosis, but I think it's really important to mention that here as well, because 1.5 million women in the UK alone, suffer with endometriosis, and that can be horrendous. It can result in chronic pain. It can cause bowel and bladder issues. It can cause depression. And obviously that has a knock-on impact on fulfilling work commitments. One thing as I go on to talk about menstruating and some of the sort of more workplace-based aspects of that is, and someone in the chat has just mentioned this, and it was on my list of things to mention, so thank you for the reminder, is I will probably refer to women because I am a woman and because I am used to talking about periods in the context of women. But it's really, really important here with my inclusion hat on to remember that it's not just women who menstruate. There are people who are trans. There are people who are gender non-binary who will be biologically programmed to menstruate. And that in itself can bring a whole host of other problems. If you are dealing with those kinds of issues, but your body is carrying on menstruating, you know, regularly or irregularly as it normally does. So I'm not going to go into that today because I'm absolutely not an expert on it. I am still learning every day. But I think it's really important to call it out and just to kind of have that in our peripheral vision. Next question. Thank you to the person who asked about paid leave for women who are on their period, because that's what I want to talk about next. So that's a perfect lead in. Thank you. So this, I think, is such an interesting topic, and I'm sure there will be different views about amongst the panelists. So I'm going to ask some views in a minute when I've had my my little run through. So there are some countries that offer, depending on the country, paid or unpaid leave for menstruating women. Japan, South Korea and Zambia are three examples I found through my research. Now, it's very interesting because I've thought quite a lot about what I think about that, and so have a lot of other people. And where I've got to on that is that I'm not sure that menstruation leave is the answer. I worry, and to your point, Adrienne, about not wanting policies for everything, I worry that, and perhaps this is my sort of conditioning to think in that kind of Don Draper prototype way, but I worry that if we have special treatment in that way for women, that it's not necessarily going to further the cause of equality. And I worry that it will actually be seen as a negative in terms of people who are hiring women or employing women, or, you know, women, again, here's another difficulty, which again comes back to that we're not quite there yet in terms of the fully inclusive workplace. I also think that there will be an impact potentially if it's unpaid leave on things like gender pay gap. So I think that's a watch out. But I do think that we need to get real about women who suffer particularly with their periods and about actually how sick leave is used in that respect. I always end up name checking my husband in these webinars, and I'm going to do that again today. So the other night I asked my husband, if you had a woman who was a really good performer, but regularly every month or so took a day off work sick, what would you think about that? And he said, well, that's really interesting, isn't it? I mean, I'd probably want to talk to them about what was going on. I thought, well done. It's a big tick in the box for you, Mr. Wilder.
He's a keeper.
But he is. Whether he thinks I'm a keeper or not remains to be seen, but he's definitely a keeper. But we then started talking about it because he works, part of his role at his place is D&I. So he's quite tuned into this stuff and he has to listen to me banging on about it every day without fail. But I kind of said, okay, well, let's switch this around. So if men, sorry, because I'm about to be slightly graphic here, so just bear with. But if men bled profusely at least one day a month from their genitals and suffered with horrendous cramps and all of the other hormonal changes we talked about, do you think they'd just go to work, or do you think they'd probably think that maybe they might want to be off sick? And I mean, he looked quite shocked and a bit horrified as he was cooking dinner, but I think he agreed that yes, there would be instances in which he thought it was reasonable for someone to take sick time in that space. I just thought that was really interesting. So I then started digging around and having to see if there was any research in this area. And actually there was a piece of research done that's set out in the British Medical Journal from 2017. And it was research that was based on nearly 33,000 women in the Netherlands. And they talked about the impact of their cycle on them in the workplace. And there was a really interesting piece there around absenteeism versus presenteeism. So the general stats were that about 14% of women reported that they were absent at some point during the year because of their period. And about 3.5%, that was every cycle. But the mean average days lost to this issue were about 1.3 days a year. So that's not huge, actually. But what they then said was that 81% reported that whilst they'd been into the office and worked, they were recognising that this was presenteeism on their part. And actually, when they analysed the impact on productivity, they reckon that about 9 days per year were lost in terms of productivity from that 81% of women who'd felt that they had to drag themselves into the office, however they felt. I thought that was really interesting. I also thought it was really interesting that only 20% of women felt that they could tell the truth about their absence. So of those women who reported absent, only 20% of them. So my maths isn't brilliant, but that's probably around 2% of the whole kind of control group felt that they could actually be honest about why they were being absent. They gave different reasons, like, you know, diarrhea or cold and flu or whatever it was. And also 67% of people said, look, we just like some more flexibility, which we all know is a buzzword of mine, around how we work during the time when we've got our period. So it's not that we necessarily need to take loads of sick leave, but we might just want to start work a little bit later on that day, or we might need to finish a little bit earlier so we can go and take some painkillers and use a hot water bottle. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. So I just wanted to share those stats. I suppose one of the things that occurs to me as an employment lawyer is would we be worried about abuse of the system? And I think that comes from my conditioning into that, you know, workplace by men for men kind of philosophy again. I suppose where I get to with that is there's always going to be someone who abuses a system. If you employ people, there is always going to be a person, no doubt, whatever the system is, who games the system. There is nothing in my 20 years of experience as an employment lawyer that has made me think differently to that. But that's not everyone. And I don't think that progressive businesses, and Verity, let's call out your cultural pioneer, because I love that phrase. I don't think businesses that want to be cultural pioneers should be basing their employment policies on the 0.5%, 0.25% who game the system. I think they should be based generally on trusting people and that people are decent and that most people will do the right thing. I want to finish my little diatribe before we kind of get into a bit more of a discussion if we've got time, with a quote that I found when I was doing my research. It's from the CEO of a company called Saka London, which is a clothing company. And the CEO, a lady called Jules McKean, said this: "Everyone I work with is measured on output. A day off with a period, a migraine, or caring for a child should not cripple a business. If it does, the fault is with the business." Mic drop.
Powerful stuff. Yeah, powerful stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting. Thoughts? That. I think that, you know, the Don Draper character, you know, that kind of man is it's very linear, isn't it? That men are generally more linear and women are more cyclical. And it's interesting because we've been talking about maybe that day a month where it's very difficult to be productive, but what we haven't talked about is in this cycle, I think women tend to find there's days where they are absolutely unstoppable. You know, you can, it's like you're superwoman, you can do everything. And there's days of the month where you're massively social and really engaging. And then there's days of the month where you're like, leave me alone. I don't want to see anyone. I just want to curl up in a ball. And I think we have to see the whole cycle. And there's kind of a tendency to label that bit that's good, that bit that's bad, instead of all of it is diversity within ourselves, which is
100%
itself. And to think, well, we can use all of that energy in a really good way, so we can really fight fires in those days where we're like rah and get it done, and we can be really reflective and on those days where we're a little bit more like, where's the duvet and the hot water bottle? But all of it is a form of productivity. Some days we're creative, some days we're social, and so on. And I think we need to kind of embrace that. And that means not, you know, allowing the workplace for women to be women in the workplace, not Don Drapers, essentially. And I think in terms of what you were talking about time off, I think the key word is flexibility, actually, because if the job is getting done, then, you know, do we have to trust people to know themselves best, to know how to do it? And sometimes, of course, we can't put everything around a cycle. Sometimes on the days where we feel we want to curl up on a ball, we have to be able to turn it on to be able to have that meeting. But if we can trust people to work with their bodies more, to say, actually, you know, today I thought I was going to do X, Y, and Z, but it's a better day for me today to do this. It doesn't mean that we can't, or we can be productive in different ways. And I think we have to allow people to do that. And maybe on there might be days where there doesn't seem to be as much activity, but if you balance it out over the entire month, those days that they're on fire, doesn't that cancel that out, you know? So do we really need the time off, or do we just need to be more flexible for people to work in a way that works for them, that as long as the job is getting done, does it matter if it's not getting done in a very linear Don Draper sort of way?
Yeah, I think you're spot on there, Emma. And I think that's really, really important, because, again, it comes back to the expectation that everyone will fit into a mold that doesn't work anymore with you know, men and women in the workplace.
I'm just going to add something in here, because I think this is an important thing to remember. As you know, it's in an office environment where people can work from home, and I think someone's mentioned the pandemic and how that's been really useful to enable people to manage themselves. That's great. What about those businesses? Because, you know, we've got a number of clients in manufacturing, they employ women in distribution centres, in retail. that's much more tricky, isn't it? Much more tricky to deal with, because those women don't have the opportunity to stay at home and manage it. So it's about encouraging businesses to, again, be alive to how they might be feeling. So you might have somebody who flies around the distribution center going, I'm on fire, I've got targets to meet, I can get all this stuff, I can pick and pack and I can do all that stuff. And I know this as well because my daughter did the dot-com picking in Tesco's, and some days her little machine would be green and other days she'd be dragging herself around, you know. And it's really important then to encourage businesses not just to think about flexibility in terms of where you might be working and how you might be working, but on certain days you know women might not be well enough to even come to work. That comes back to the point about leave, but also they may not be as quick, they may not be on fire, and it's just having that sort of that understanding for those workers as well.
And I think that's where the sick leave policy and having a proper sick leave policy that actually permits people to use it if they are sick because of their periods, and yes, actually not again back to that word taboo, not having that being a taboo subject. So if I've got horrendous cramps and I'm worried that I'm someone who happens to bleed really heavily, I'm talking hypothetically here rather than oversharing once again, I should be able to call in and say, I'm sorry, I'm not very well today, I'm not going to be able to come into the office, and not have to make up a reason for that. You know, I'm vomiting, you know, I'm sorry, my period's really heavy. You know, as we know from experience, this tends to last about a day, so I should be back in tomorrow, but I can't come and be on the line today because, you know, I mean, some people bleed so heavily that they end up with anemia, you know, so this is really serious. So I think it's a really good point, Adrienne. And I think that's where, for those industries where, you know, it's not just your white collar workers in an office or working from home, I think that's where you've got to kind of destigmatize this as a way to use your sickness policy if necessary.
And then also encouraging women to be more open about the reason why they're off, because, you know, there'll be many employers that use various different sickness absence management tracking, you know, Bradford factors, one of them, etc. And if if women are encouraged to put down, you know, stomach bug, headache and stuff like that, those then start to be, I was going to say red flags, but it's really inappropriate, but those start to be markers which actually don't give the true picture of what's happening. So they're doing themselves a disservice, hence why it comes back to that education piece about let's be open about it, let's encourage that conversation.
I think in its purity, this is sort of about valuing your workforce, really, isn't it? And the difference in your workforce and understanding what an individual's needs are and working with them to support them on that. And it may be flexible working in some, you know, workplaces works, but in others, for example, if you're a teacher, you can't just, you know, rock up to a class late because, you know, the children are there. So it's about, you know, working to find, you know, the solution for the individual. Mm. And I think you get that back in spades in loyalty and commitment and productivity.
And staff retention.
And staff retention, yeah, which then impacts your gender diversity, your gender pay gap, and et cetera.
Yeah.
I feel like we probably don't want to do the last section, which is a super important one, a disservice. So I think it's probably a good opportunity for us to move on and to talk about this last really important, and as Verity said earlier, potentially quite triggering section on fertility and pregnancy loss. So Verity and Emma, I think over to you on this one.
Thank you, Sarah. Yeah, so it is a difficult subject, this, and the truth of the matter is, you know, one in four women, I think the statistics are now still, suffer a miscarriage in their fertility journey. And I think one in six couples struggle with fertility just in general. You know, there are some women who aren't as lucky to even fall pregnant. So, I mean, if you look amongst your peers who you work with or just your friends, you know, you're bound to know somebody, or you may not even know because they don't even want to talk about it, that are going through these struggles. You know, I feel that over the last year, this has gained some publicity, and it may be because I'm more sensitive to it. But I think it definitely feels to me like people are talking about it more. I know a lot of organisations are bringing in pregnancy loss leave, or some firms are fortunate enough to even be funding fertility. I think I saw that on your LinkedIn, which is fascinating. But, you know, the truth is, it's a very difficult subject to raise and have an understanding about. And if I'm honest with you, a year ago, I knew about miscarriages, but did I really understand it? I don't think you really do until you've been through it yourself. You know, a year ago, I would have had some sympathy to it, but I just didn't have an understanding of it. You know, it wasn't until I suffered with my first miscarriage, probably this time last year, I think it was, where it really shook me. And, you know, I woke up and just went to work. It was lockdown and I carried on my Zoom calls. You know, looking back now, I think, what the hell was I doing? But, you know, I think you don't know what to do. You're in sort of panic mode. And then when it came round to my second loss, that's when I really realised that I couldn't do it alone. And thankfully, you know, I had no qualms in picking up the phone to, you know, my lovely boss, Mark, and say, I just can't do this. And he just said, just do what you've got to do. And, you know, without the support of my team, Sarah, Peter, Adrienne, it was a very difficult time. Not only physically, I think, for women, I think there's two things you've got to remember here. There's a physical aspect of it, and there's also an emotional, mental aspect, because it wasn't until a couple of months later that I think I saw Adrienne in the office, like maybe 3 months after the event. And we got chatting and she was like, you don't look right, is everything okay? And, you know, in a very frank, direct way, me and Adrienne had a chat. And if it wasn't for the discussion I had with her, I don't think I would have gone and got the right support, if I'm honest with you. So I think for me, there's two things here, you know, understanding how we can support women in going through these struggles, both, you know, at the time it's happening, but also after the event. And, you know, it is a very traumatic process going through pregnancy loss, and with fertility as well, it can be years and years of enduring this process. And I think, you know, we touched on this earlier. Is it enough to have a policy? I don't think this is the kind of thing where a policy is good enough. For me, it's about educating staff, educating managers about the process and what women have to go through. So Emma, I think, you know, look, you know, way more than me in terms of advising businesses and individuals. Where do you think businesses should start? Like, if you didn't have anything in place, what do you think would be the one thing that you would recommend?
If you've done absolutely nothing on this at all, then the starting point is really starting the conversation. And raising a little bit of awareness. And I find that a lot of clients find that it's a good place to start with this kind of workplace session, a workplace training presentation that puts it out there and says, fertility, baby loss, we recognize this is a workplace issue. And this is why it matters to us. And we want to do something about it. And that kind of just sort of breaks down a little bit of the silence and allows a little conversation to start. And it's a real launch pad then for what you can go forward and do after that. And that can look like then having some bit more facilitated conversations with the workforce about what their experiences are and what they feel that they would need. So you can kind of co-create, because every workplace is different, what's required in your workplace, and that can inform then policy and strategy going forward. And you can then go into more kind of tailored and detailed training sessions that might suit HR versus line managers and colleagues and so on. But I think the first point has always got to be just starting the conversation and starting it across the board. Because, I mean, this is called not just women's issues, and I think it is important that it is an issue for everybody, not just you mentioned it's the 1 in 6 couples having fertility issues, but there's also the LGBTQ+ community that needs support to have the families that they want to have. Not everybody is in a relationship and they still want to have a family, and naturally they have some challenges to do that as well. And miscarriage, you mentioned, again, 1 in 4 pregnancies end in miscarriage. And sometimes the male partner or the other female partner the person who hasn't been doing the carrying can get a little bit forgotten in that as well. Whereas, you know, there's a physical impact for the person who's carrying or receiving the treatment, but the mental and emotional impact, which is enormous, it goes to the partners as well. I think it's sort of 90% of people having fertility treatment experience depression, 42% can have suicidal thoughts, and a third of women who've had a miscarriage can experience post-traumatic stress within the first month. So these are really serious issues, so it's inevitable, of course, that then impacts the workplace.
Definitely. I think, you know, you've definitely touched on a point there in terms of the trauma. I think the long-term effects are really important, because having a manager that can potentially see signs of it and understand that, you know, a bit like Adrienne, you know, seeing where something's not quite right, let's have a conversation, is everything okay? Because, you know, people might think the event is itself one thing, and okay, it's done with, but actually it's more of the longer term impact. And like you say, with fertility treatment, goes on for years. It's very impactful on someone's life. So yeah, I mean, that's great. I think you're right, starting the conversation is key. And actually touching on what we talked about earlier about having perhaps groups, maybe within organizations, you know, women could actually lean on each other and find some sort of solace. And because I think the thing about pregnancy loss and fertility, I don't know if anybody's ever struggled with it, but there's like this secret society that no one wants to be part of, that you suddenly become part of, and then you realize that nobody else around you is talking about it apart from the people it's happening to.
Not even necessarily the people it's happening to. I mean, I've been on the fertility journey for over 10 years, and 6 years of that was while I was working as a lawyer in Marks and Spencer, and completely trying to manage it silently and thinking, you know, it's an incredibly lonely experience, as is miscarriage. I've been through that several times as well, and it does feel very lonely and isolating. But as soon as I started to talk about it and started to do the work that I'm doing now, you know, people are falling all over themselves to tell me that they were going through or are going through the same thing. And you know, if I look back to those days, if I said hands up on my floor who's going through the similar issue, I mean, there would have been so many other people just sat within meters of me who were struggling with the same thing. And a lot of organizations think, oh, it's not happening here. And they think it's not happening here because we're not talking about it. But we've mentioned those stats now, the 1 in 6, the 1 in 4. And if you go and apply them to your demographic, it's happening.
I think there's a really good point that's just been made when we're talking about it. I mean, there's the issue of not wanting to talk about it widely, you know, in case you jinx it or in case it doesn't happen, and having to face the disappointment in the event that it doesn't work out. But in a workplace as well, as the comment in the chat box has said, is that people are going to be terrified that, you know, if you say, hey, I'm going through IVF treatment, you know, bear with me, it's going to impact on their career. You know, their manager's first response is, oh, great, how am I going to cope with the time off? When are they going to go off with pregnancy? It then starts to lead into all the sort of the more traditional discriminatory type of aspects of hiring women who then take maternity leave, for example. And I think that is a massive, massive barrier to opening up about it in the workplace. I really do.
Yeah, and we've got this culture, haven't we, if you don't talk about a pregnancy until you get to the 12-week mark, which, you know, it has a lot of people who are just struggling with early pregnancy, struggling in silence. I mean, how many people who go on to have a healthy pregnancy or like being sick in the toilets or whatever they're doing, that, you know, if they could have just talked to the manager about what was happening, would have supported them through that process. And then there's the people who are going through losses and going through them in silence because we've decided it with the, I think it's with the 12-week scan, actually, that somehow it's not appropriate to talk about it. It's too uncomfortable, whatever it is, until after 12 weeks. And we're kind of shooting ourselves a little bit in the foot there by doing that, because there's so many people that aren't getting support that they need, whether it's with losses or whether it's actually just with the difficulty of dealing with early pregnancy while they're at work.
Yeah. I think there's been another really good point raised in the chat, and this is the point that makes my blood boil. So just bear with me, and if I get too ranty, start talking over me.
The point
that's been made is, and I get it, I really do get it, but there is a stigma around being off on maternity leave potentially. Mm-hmm. So let's say that your fertility journey ultimately ends in a healthy pregnancy. And then particularly for SMEs, it's kind of, oh God, we've got some, she's going on maternity leave. And this I think is really hard. And I think it also comes down to ultimately the fact that we are still in this world where the norm is to be male and never have any time off for any reason related to women's issues. Now I totally understand that for SMEs, you know, the impact of having someone off on maternity leave is greater, but my view is if I ever set up a business, I would make sure that I factored in as part of the cost of doing business the fact that at some point someone might go on maternity leave. Now I just would, because if you are going to employ women, and just in case anyone's in any doubt about this, it is unlawful not to employ women just because they're a woman. So I wouldn't recommend that. It is a cost of doing business, and it's not okay that in 2022, it is still seen as an inconvenience, because we've just got to change the mindset, you know, all of our mindsets, I think, on that.
Well, people could be off sick, people can leave. You know, there are absences from businesses for a myriad of reasons. So why should this one be the same thing?
And yes, you're missing out on a valuable and talented section of the workforce if you start excluding, you know, people because they, you know, want to go through these natural life experiences and stages. You know, they've got a lot to bring to a business.
100%. I mean, there is a real talent drain if that's the route you take. Emma, bringing it back, sorry, I've just had to have my rant because it just makes me so cross. But I'm through it now, for now. Emma, we've talked a bit about the one thing that businesses could do to start the conversation, and I'm conscious of time here because we've now reached midday, but one question that I've got for you is, let's just flip that around and let's live in the nirvana that I want to live in, where everyone's included and, you know, we're all operating under a gold standard. Mm-hmm. What would be your kind of gold standard workplace approach to fertility and pregnancy loss issues?
For me, and we touched on some of these with menopause, I think of it as being, there's three key things. There's acknowledgement, understanding, and support. And the pillars, I think, that hold all of those up are education, policy, and strategy. And the acknowledgement part of it is, as an organisation, the acknowledgement that these are workplace matters. And then it's on a one-to-one basis, the acknowledgement of each individual experience for what that is, again, suspending kind of comparisons and judgments. The understanding part is the kind of understanding why this is relevant to a workplace and what people are going through and how they're impacted and what's the right way of managing it. So that's the kind of bigger education part of it. And then on a one-to-one basis, again, it's having those conversations to seek to understand what is going on for an individual, every miscarriage being different, every fertility issue being different. What is the experience of that individual and what are their needs? And then the kind of supporting bit is then, you know, again, what can you do as an organisation to embed this support, this fertility and baby loss in the workplace, and create this open and diverse and inclusive workplace? And on a one-to-one basis, what can you do to go away and meet their needs? And as I say, kind of, I think the education bit, the raising the awareness, the policy, and I know you made some comment earlier about, Adrienne, about you not being a fan of policy. And I think it's important with policy to have some parameters that set expectations and give confidence to managers about what to do and to individuals about what to expect, but doesn't get rid of complete discretion and the ability to work with individuals on a one-to-one basis and be responsive to what's happening on a one-to-one basis. It can't be completely rigid and black and white. And the strategy bits, which, as I say, is about, you know, how do you make this more than a policy that sits on your intranet? but how do you make you live and breathe it in with your employees, with your clients, with your suppliers? How do you kind of just make it part of your culture, really?
I think those are very wise words. Thank you.
Thank you. Look, we're going to have to wrap up now, but thank you so much to everybody for contributing. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Meredith. Thanks, Adrian and Sarah. It's been, you know, the feedback has been amazing. Everybody has been delighted with the conversation, and I think we're definitely going to have to go ahead with that roundtable discussion, guys. So let's get that organised. The recording will be available in a couple of days. We'll circulate that. We'll be back next week with our EL 101. I think it's grievances and managing conflict at work. So join us next week at 11. And thank you, everybody, for contributing. It's been a delight. And have a lovely rest of the day.
Thanks, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.